Michael Veitch, welcome to the Last Post podcast interview. It's a pleasure speaking with you. How are you?
Oh, the pleasure's mine, Greg. I'm very well. Thank you very much, old son.
Thank you so much, Michael. Now, of course, you're an author, you're an actor, a broadcaster. A lot of us include...
You're going... A man of many bills, as my wife says.
Well, talented...
which I have to pay.
That's right. Talented in all of them too, Michael. A lot of us first saw you on the television with the D-Generation and Fast Forward, etc. But, of course, you're a lot more than that. Tell us about your role in the RAF, Michael.
Well, I've had this interest all my life. I never actually expected to be given the honour of being asked to come into the reserve in the History and Heritage Department. Yeah. And it all started really just because the last book I published was about the Battle of Milne Bay, the very important Battle of Milne Bay, which I'm sure your readers know about as the first defeat of the Japanese on land.
My father was in that battalion.
Good heavens, was he?
Second tent.
Oh, should have chatted. All right, I'll pick your brains for the second edition when it comes out.
That's right. No, we'll have to get together, but it's great. But go on about Milne Bay, because this is of great interest to readers and listeners.
Indeed. Well, I mean, it's an extraordinary story and one of those chronicles of Australian military endeavours that, of course, nobody knows anything about.
Mm.
And I've often said if we were Americans, which, thank goodness we're not, we'd nonetheless, you know, the people who fought the Battle of Milne Bay would be on our stamps and things like that, but we just don't tend to do that. So, although it's part of my role was to, you know, being able to write a bit and having this interest was to sort of bring the stories of untold service stories to the fore and to the public. So that's been my entire writing career. And the last couple of books, because it started with me tracking down old fellas who had flown in the RAF and the RAF, and also a couple of the South African Air Force, and just any airman of the Second World War who basically hadn't spoken to anyone about it, and this often was including their own families, and interviewing them often for the first time. And it was an incredibly moving experience for me, and they're all gone now, and it's one of the most profound things I've ever done in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it started off as a kind of a information gathering exercise, really, but I realised it was far more moving than that, not just for me, but for the people I was interviewing as well, being often the first time they'd spoken about the war experiences.
Yes.
So the last book I wrote was about Milne Bay, and indeed that was another kind of untold story. Very little has been written about it specifically. A little bit.
Mm.
And there are a couple of good books, but not recently, and not written in a kind of a style that I like. I'm actually not very good with military history, traditional military history, because I'm not a historian, I'm a storyteller.
Yes, yes.
And I often have to correct people for that. I was a bit of a historian when I wrote a book called Hellship about... but it's not a war story. It's about a clipper ship that arrived with my great great grandfather on board 100 or so years ago, and I had to be an historian for that. But I'm essentially a storyteller.
Well, this is the thing about your writing, Michael. This is the thing about your writing. You're taken into the fact that you are a storyteller, which makes it so easy to read because it's like a conversation in many ways. And interviewing those people involved with your books must have been just a brilliant thing, and you've been able to translate that to the reader through your books.
Well, thank you. That's what I've tried to do. I mean, the reason I write like I do is because that's kind of, it's a bit selfish there, because that's the sort of stuff that I want to read. Mm. I've always loved history, but it was never taught to me well. And I think a lot of kids would like history more now if it was taught to them properly. I mean, if the drama and the story of history was emphasised rather than lots of dates and things. I mean, yeah, it's extraordinary, right, the amount of military historians that are brilliant and well known that I find hard to read. I mean, look, I appreciate Anthony Beevor, who is a genius, but I find him hard to read because I get so bogged down in what unit was doing this and what, and it's like, I can't take this in, but what's actually happening?
I know.
So that's not to disparage Anthony, because I actually know Anthony, and when he comes to Australia, I often host his public events and
But that's his style of writing, Michael, and it's been successful. But for you and I and a lot of other people also, I'm right on song with you there, because there's a couple of books that I've picked up on events in war that I thought I would... And then I've given up halfway because of that very reason you just said.
Yeah, same. So it's a very long answer to a very simple question, Greg. And so when I did the Milne Bay book, the RAAF got me to come up and give a talk on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they asked, look, thank you for that, it was great. Would you be interested in, because our big centenary is next year.
Yes.
This is last year, of course. And it's March 2021 is the 100th birthday of the RAAF, the second oldest air force in the world.
Incredible.
And would you like to help us with it? And I said, I'd be honoured. And then they said, well, actually, it's actually easier for us if you're in the organisation. And I said, what? And they said, would you be interested in applying for? And I had to apply. I had to go through the ropes to be a reserve officer and work with us in the history and heritage department. And I said, well, that would have been churlish of me to say no. So
you're an officer.
I'm an officer. Yeah, I'm a squadron leader.
Do people salute you?
Well, they would have if we hadn't had a COVID year. I would have been out doing a couple of things, and I've yet to have my proper training because that's all been delayed as well.
So.
I dare not. I mean, I actually was in the Air Training Corps as a kid.
Oh wow!
Which actually helped my application somewhat too. but that was, you know, a very, very long time ago.
Mm, mm.
So my job with them now is to do what I love doing, telling the story and bringing the history of the RAAF in particular to light, particularly bearing this very important centenary coming up next year.
Yes, that's right too, Michael. And of course, we have a list of questions here to ask about that, and I'm sure that this will help with an understanding for people about the RAAF, the second oldest air force in the world. Where are Air Force members currently deployed, Michael?
In various locations, I don't really know. Some of the more ones that are not public, I'm sure there are. But as we know, Afghanistan, I think at the moment.
Yep.
But it's more, what I find fascinating is more not where the Air Force is, but what they do. And what I've learned is the variety of activities that the RAAF engage in now.
Yes.
In one of the books we've been doing, a presentation book that I've been part of the team working on, the picture catalogue we've been going through, for images like, my favourite is of a C-130, this amazing image, dropping hay bales out the rear door for drought relief.
Right.
It was a couple of years ago, and this guy standing there watching these enormous bales of hay, big square blocks of hay being dropped to starving cows somewhere in Australia during drought relief. Now, who knew that the RAAF engaged in that kind of thing? All the peacekeeping exercises, cyclone and flooding relief, human interaction with disasters.
Yeah, and I think too, Michael, like it's saying, I think for a lot of people, what you just said hits the nail on the head. A lot of people, and I guess there doesn't need to be wars for the RAAF to be able to help people. We've seen this with community disasters, the bushfires, the droughts, the floods. It's a wonderful job that's done, and I guess a lot of Australians will be drawn towards celebrating the centenary next year. So, I mean, yeah, exactly.
I hope so, because the RAAF is a small but very dynamic and very sort of upwardly mobile organisation. It's open to change. It's accepted change. It's accepted the changes in the way society has moved. It's a very diverse organization now.
Mm-hmm.
It's welcoming of different creeds and colors and genders and faiths and all sorts of things, which is what you kind of, you know, which is what you want in an organization that's committed to representing you on the world stage and indeed defending you. So I'm actually very proud to be part of it. I mean, hey, if they accepted me,
that's right. It's an incredible thing. And I mean, I was going to say something about your past life as a comedian, but we'll leave that to the next interview. I think.
Oh no, I'm happy to talk about that. From what I remember.
That's right. Well, they were amazing days. But I tell you what, I think that's worth an interview on its own too. So that'll be something to look forward to. But I guess, and you just spoke about inclusion too, Michael, of different people in the RAF with the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in the Air Force currently.
There's a great story, and it's a Second World War story regarding Len Waters, who was the first Indigenous fighter pilot.
That's right.
Now, he came into the RAF early in the war, where there was officially a government kind of colour ban, saying, well, no, people they must look a certain way. And the RAAF just completely ignored it and said, no, we're happy to have him. He's a good bloke. And they trained him to be a kiddie-walk pilot, and he served with 76 Squadron, I think, up in the islands. And by his accounts, by Len's accounts and Len's family's accounts, he was completely accepted. He was far more accepted when he was in the RAF flying than when he came back.
Yes.
His civilian life afterwards. So he, from what I understand, he looked back at his flying days as a completely kind of prejudice-free period of his life, and there are not many Indigenous Australians of that era that can actually say that either.
That must have been a blessing at the time for Len, because, of course, we hear these stories too, Michael, and of discrimination upon return where there had been none in the fighting force. And I know some actually, I don't know if this was World War II or the beginning of World War II, where some Indigenous soldiers had to go and register in England through a third sort of way of getting into the army, which was quite ludicrous.
That wouldn't surprise me.
And looking beyond 2021, what will the Air Force of the future look like, Michael? I mean, there's lots of, we're just talking about community acts, ways of helping Australians through ways that aren't war-driven or warfare. But how will it look, do you think, with the centenary and beyond?
It's hard to say. Who knows what the future may bring. I think the days, with the world being what it is, I think the days of vast armies meeting each other are probably over.
Mm.
I think the days of, armies, recruited amateur armed forces, millions strong, I just don't think it's going to happen anymore. I can't see how it would benefit anyone with technology being the way it actually is. So I think it's going to continue to engage using available technology. I've just been, one of the things I've been doing for the Air Force is hosting a podcast, yes, believe it or
oh,
not,
wow.
called Conversations on the Runway about space.
Wow, and how can about people space? Access that?
Google it, Conversations on the Runway. It's the RAAF's podcast.
Yep.
Series. I've done 9 episodes discussing all aspects of contemporary space, the militarization of space, the union between civil and military interests, actors, they call them, in space, where things are going. I spoke to a senior American officer, and space is the new high ground. The new high ground of any battle situation is going to be space.
Yes.
And that particularly that lower Earth orbit. I mean, when you think of it, it's actually so close, but it's upwards.
Mm.
But it's, from here to, when I'm in Melbourne, from here to the, not even the Victorian border, upwards,
yep.
You're very much in space, and that's where satellites are, that's how far away from us satellites are circling the Earth. and our dependency on satellite technology, not just military but civil,
yes,
is going to become so profound that it's going to be a very, very highly debated area. So that's the sort of areas, I think, rather than sort of, you know, fleets of aircraft that are simply too expensive to build and supply in
yep.
vast numbers. You know, it's not like, I mean, even in World War II, for the British to churn out a Lancaster bomber was the equivalent of us in the 80s making the space shuttle because the technology was so advanced.
Wow.
We can't do that anymore. There's simply not, it's simply not possible. So doing more with less.
And
finding more ways to engage the Australian community is going to be the future direction of the RAAF going into the next century.
Yes, well, very well said, Michael. And, of course, you started off by the reference to space and how close it is. And that gives, of course, a clearer definition of our smallness. And it's a scary thought. But, of course, space, and you rightfully so point this out, that this more than likely will be the area where things are focused for the future, with the less reluctance to engage fully on Earth with large armies. Thank heavens for that, at least, too.
Yes.
What are you up to yourself, 21, for the RAF?
Book-related, I'm working on book number 10 at the moment, and I'm late for it already. I'm sitting at my desk with my computer open, with some excellent publications I'm searching. I've got Pacific Fury, Peter Thompson's. I've got Mark Johnson's Whispering Death, which is excellent.
Yep.
Bowfighter Boys by Graham Pitchfork. And a couple of other letters and things, because my next book is about the Battle of the Bismarck Sea.
Wow.
Which is another extraordinary engagement.
Yes.
That we know very little about, but it was incredibly important. And it was historically speaking, very important for a couple of reasons. It was Japan's last gasp in
yes.
New Guinea. If they'd won this battle, the Pacific War could have stayed around our area for much, much longer and would have been far more costly and bloody. And it was at the beginning of 1943 when Japan had sort of sucked up its losses of Kokoda and Guadalcanal and said, you know, we don't need all those extra areas. We can just concentrate on New Guinea. As long as we have our primary goal of New Guinea, we can keep it and we can still win this. And they were right. They could have, too. If they'd eventually taken Port Moresby, it would have been a very different situation. So this was their last gasp, and it was a very big convoy for that time. It was 16 ships, which was
wow.
the Pacific at that time was a big convoy to reinforce the Japanese garrison at Lae on the northern coast of Papua, and a smaller convoy a couple of months before had gotten through almost unmolested. And it was considered a disaster by the Allies. How did this convoy get through? Why couldn't we attack? Why couldn't we sink any of these ships? And so the Japanese said, well, we'll send a bigger one with a half a division on board to reinforce Lae. We'll take places like Higher Base at Wau.
Yep.
We'll have that, and then we can push on to Moresby that way. Every single one of those ships in that convoy was sunk. Every single one of them,
16
entirely by aircraft of the RAAF and the United States Fifth Army Air Force.
Wow.
And the story of how it came about, and through a couple of remarkable personalities, one of which is a guy called Bull Gehring.
Right.
Group Captain Gehring, a tough, nuggety bloke from Corion, high up in the mountain country of the New South Wales Victorian border, tough as nails, but a very clever pilot, brilliant pilot, and he said to the Americans, the only way to do it is to concentrate your forces. And they said, well, what do you mean? And he told them how to do it, and it worked. And it was a remarkable story.
So that was thanks to Bull, and that'll be in your book.
Yes. It will be that, yes, it will be about the Battle of Bismarck Sea, hopefully next August. I'm trying to finish it before my deadline of March, April this year.
Well, we want you to keep going and writing some brilliant stuff that you do, Michael, through your interest in aviation and warfare. And there's a lot of things people can learn. And if you could give details of your podcast again, please.
It's called just Google Conversations on the Runway. There are several episodes. Look for the space. So, Royal Australian Air Force dedicated podcast series.
Yep.
And I've done 9 of them pertaining to space. And I think they're pretty good too. Mainly because of the issues that we're able to get some terrific people from all over the world. And many of the finest people working in space around the world are here in Australia, and particularly in Adelaide.
Oh, wow, my hometown.
Yeah, a huge hub of the finest space brains in Adelaide and Canberra, and they're all a delight to talk to as well, and it's quite fascinating. What I learned, I never thought I'd learn so much about space in such a short a time and remain interested in it, but that's what I managed to do.
Well, the next thing is, Michael, you'll have to go up in space.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
Yep.
Yeah. I'll get working on that.
You do a podcast from space.
I might have to ask Mr. Branson for a ticket on his Virgin crop, or maybe Mr. Musk. I'm not quite sure.
Well, one of the two. But you have had some experience in the air with your skits on Fast Forward, so.
Indeed. I don't know if that. Well, look, that might keep me in good stead. I'm not sure.
Well, you've got some experience, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure, and for your role with the RAF, and thanks for talking to us about the RAF centenary starting next year, of course, and 100 years in March, the second oldest air force in the world. So thank you so much, Michael.
You're very welcome, Greg. It's been great to talk to you, and best wishes to all your readers.